Hello, friends, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. I have really exciting news this week. The two-player game of Forbidden Love that you may have heard of as Tension has a new name. It's called Starcrossed, and it's coming to Kickstarter April 10th. So look out for some awesome rewards, some surprises during the campaign, and some gorgeous game art by none other than Ignatz Award-winning comics artist Jess Fink. I am so excited to get to start revealing a couple of details about this Kickstarter campaign. It just means so much to me to get to share this game with the world. See you in April. Anyway, if you want to know more about the game, you can go to bullypulpitgames.com. You can see it under Our Games because I'm publishing it with them because they're the best. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at Muscular Pikachu, and I tweet about the game a lot, but in like a fun way. Anyway, my guest today is game designer and interactive media writer Cleo Yunsu Davis. Cleo brings a background in interactive theater as well as game design to make incredibly compelling live action and tabletop games. She won a Golden Cobra Award for her LARP, The Long Drive Back from Busan, which is about being in a K-pop band that, well, I mean, playing it made me want to instantly have her on the show, so what else do I need to say? She's great. Let's jump in. Actually want to warm up by asking you about Read, Watch, Play. This the podcast that you've been doing for a while, which I didn't even know you had, and now it's so cool. I have it on my phone. I get to listen to you guys talk about like games and books and like kind of just whatever you want.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a book club, except for we're also covering video games and movies and sometimes TV shows. The idea being that we do these kind of mini series and they're centered around a theme. So we'll watch a movie, read a book, and then play a game that all are connected by that theme. But we're wrapping that up after about, I want to say like 2.5 years.
That's wild.
Yeah, it's all people who I met through the NYU Game Center back in undergrad. So like we've known each other for a while. It was kind of just an excuse at first to hang out and like talk about geeky stuff.
Yes, good. Yeah. Well, I mean, how do you feel about kind of letting go of a project like that after so long?
I think the main thing I'm worried about is just like that was my main connection to that group of friends. And I'm hoping that we'll still stay in contact and talk about geeky stuff all the time. But it is a weird feeling because we all felt it was, you know, time to wrap it up because, you know, we've been going with it for a while and we're all super busy people who are being pulled in like a million directions. And I'm going to miss podcasting in general a lot because it's just a format I really love.
I kind of feel that way too, a little bit. Like it's just a really nice kind of like very human connection to other people, especially when you're sharing something that you feel strongly about. And that can come up surprisingly a lot, even when you're just talking about, you know, I just read this book or I just played this game or, you know, returned to this book series or whatever.
Yeah, there's something really also personal and intimate about just hearing someone's voice and having them like in your ear. Now Alex is going to have like this image of me listening to Backstory being like, yes, B, whispering into my ear.
It is like very intimate in a kind of like really odd way. Like when you think about not just each other as you're talking to each other, but also like the way that you keep other people company and you're like in their lives and in the context of their lives. I talk about this all the time because it just fascinates and weirds me out.
Yeah. Funny story, but really it's like somewhat a horrific story. I was in a car accident.
Oh my gosh.
Knocked over, and I had a really bad concussion. And so there were like no screen time, no anything, basically just like lie in bed, don't do anything. And so I couldn't even read books because my vision was totally messed up. And so I just listened to audiobooks and podcasts and I just like got through like all of Backstory, every like thing that I hadn't caught up on. I listened to like so many episodes, and including Alex Rowland's episode where she mentions Halasco. And so I've set for myself a goal of like, when I'm better, I'm going to run Halasco. And that's what I'm going to know that I've like recovered from this concussion enough to be functional.
Wow.
And then I ran it and we had a great time. And I felt like that was like a recovery milestone.
Yeah, hugely. That's, I think, like running live action games, especially something that's kind of like complex, like thematically, that takes so much brain space and so much like attending to so many different cues. I can totally see why that would feel like, yeah, just kind of a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, and I'm definitely one of those people who has facilitation anxiety. So even like on a normal day. So whenever I'm at a, like I just ran the long drive back from Busan for the first time actually that I've run it, like other people have run it, but this is my first time running it at Dreamation just a few days ago. And I was like horrendously nervous about that because I just, you know, I get imposter syndrome. I think everybody, no matter like what level of their, you know, design career they're at, they still suffer from that a lot of the time. But it went really well. I mean, I had a great group of players, so that always helps when you really trust the group that you're with to kind of be patient with you if there's a hiccup, or, you know, you can trust them to make interesting, good decisions on their own.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder, you know, I talk to people a lot who either want to start facilitating LARPs, or people like me who have done it a million times and yet it's still so deeply terrifying every single time, like for no reason. Even though, you know, it's always fine. People have an experience and it's great. And if they don't have a great experience, it's generally not your fault. So when you have that feeling, like when that imposter syndrome or anxiety comes on, what is your internal response to it? How do you get through it?
I think I do like to check in with people who I've run games for in the past and be just kind of ask for reassurance from them, because often, you know, it pretty much never goes as badly as you remember it having gone, even if you had like a bad experience, or like you'll obsess over one little thing that you replay in your mind over and over again. And then nobody else from that group remembers that like you said something, like you pronounced a name wrong, or like you, like a name that you created yourself in the game. Or that like you just got like something really basic mixed up, or that you spaced out and, you know, just lost track of where the game was going for a second. Because that's like, it's human. It's hard to be super tuned in all the time, especially when you're keeping track of like a lot of different players, depending on how many people are in your game. Sometimes it's hard to keep track of like three players. I think also one of the things that I would recommend for sure is if you write games, start facilitating games that you did not write. Because if you're starting off facilitating games that you did write, and things are going not the way you thought they would or not the way you would like, you're going to start worrying, okay, is this because I'm a bad facilitator, or is this because my game design is bad? And if you just take that question off the table, you're going to be able to concentrate a lot better.
Yeah, definitely. Oh my gosh, I would not want those two competing anxieties.
Yeah, I messed that up. I mean, when it came to starting to run like freeform games, I definitely GM'd as a tabletop person for a while before that. So that helped a lot. That's also something I would potentially recommend, is like if you're nervous about doing something that's like on your feet and requires movement or some kind of physicality, maybe just start with something soft at the table that's still like very storytelling intensive, because it's just like add elements one at a time. Don't jump in all at once.
Well, I totally agree with you, right? Because when you're at the table, it's still complex and there's lots of things to keep track of, but all of your players are in one place. They don't wander off and go and do their own things, and you have to like sit on the opposite side of the room and be like, those two are having a conversation. It's literally impossible to tell if it's going well or not. Maybe they're just in character, very serious. Like, I mean, this is why we have the okay check-in, I guess, but like, yeah, there is something a little bit reassuring about kind of having everyone in one place. But at the same time, like when you can let go of that and let people just go and play and wander off and have their stories, that I think is really healthy. But going back to introducing LARPy things into your tabletop very slowly, I totally saw a picture of you randomly improvising a funeral at a game of Night Witches at Dreamation.
Yeah, so that was like, yeah, it was four tables of units or of sections, and it got really intense and in a good way. And it was the first time I'd ever played Night Witches, and there was a lot of interesting intertable dynamics going on, like people pranking each other, or like for instance, like someone stole our like plane parking spots, and then we ended up like blocking them in because we were pissed off about it. And then someone, yeah, we had a lot of death at our table. We didn't do so well. We lost a lot of planes and a lot of people. And so someone came up to me and was like, do you want to run this funeral for this character, Sveta? I think actually they asked me, are you good at talking? And I was like, I hope so. And so I just kind of, and I think in that picture, I'm smiling because I was just like, oh God, this is like, I have to perform a eulogy right now and make up stuff about how I felt about this character. And there's something inherent, like even if it's serious, there's something a little bit inherently goofy about that because we were being a little bit over the top. And it was a fun moment though, because especially looking back on it, I didn't realize at the time that it was a weird thing to do, because I had been LARPing pretty much all weekend. And I think a lot of people at the table had been too. And so it felt totally natural just to stand up and do stuff on our feet. I hadn't even thought of it as, oh, we're like doing something outside the normal parameters of the game. I was just like, oh yeah, this is completely normal LARP funeral right now.
Yeah, totally. And I get really excited by the way that people can incorporate those kinds of elements, whether it's, okay, we as a LARP group are going to sit down for this phase and like this kind of take place at a table, and then we move back into like an embodied way. Like, I think there's so much potential there. I love that kind of cross-pollination. I want it to happen more.
Yeah, definitely. It's really fun when it happens organically, especially like if you don't, I don't think any of us were thinking, now we make this a LARP. It just kind of happened totally naturally, which was really fun to look at in retrospect.
I want to just quickly ask about your background in game design. You briefly mentioned that you studied at the NYU Game Center. Is that right?
Yeah, so that was way back when. That was an undergrad. I got a minor in game design back when that program was really just starting, and it was only a minor. And I met a lot of my friends who I'm still in touch with from undergrad. Most of my friends who I'm actually in touch with from undergrad are from the game design program and not from film and television, which is what I actually majored in. And it was interesting because when I started having an interest in designing games, it was much more focused on digital stuff. I think that's because that was mostly what I consumed. Like, I grew up with Dungeons and Dragons and a lot of tabletop, but I think digital was really where my focus was. And then I had to design a lot of board games and card games and other types of just tabletop games during that program. And that kind of shifted my whole perspective about what those games could be. And then when I did NYU for grad school also. Apparently I'm just like obsessed with NYU. And then I went to the Interactive Telecommunications program at Tisch, which is the master's program. That's kind of, it's such a, I used to call it like Hogwarts for sci-fi people. Because it's a little bit like engineering school mixed with art school mixed with like, what the hell are we doing? Like, I'm going to come up with something random and just go with it. Because I definitely focused really heavily on interactive and immersive storytelling when I was there. I just like made that what my program was about. Meanwhile, like, I had friends who were just focusing on programming and robotics. And it was just very different experience for all of us. But that's also how I got involved initially in immersive and interactive theater, which ended up being kind of my gateway drug to LARP.
That's amazing. So how did that happen exactly? Because I know that immersive theater is like huge right now and it's super, super popular. It seems to me really connected to LARP, but I don't know. I don't know if there are actually mechanisms to go from theater into play. So how did that happen for you?
So for me, it's interesting because this is such a touchy subject for some people. Like, if you bring up immersive theater and LARP, people will immediately kind of go on edge a lot of the time because... Well, I'll talk about that in a second, but I started my first immersive theater show that I went to was, of course, Sleep No More. And I don't want to say I became a super fan, because the super fans are people who have gone like 90 plus times, which for me, I don't understand how anybody can afford that. But I've been like 5 or 6 times. And then I've gone to a lot of their, they had like a New Year's party, and I've been to that a couple of times, and they have like Halloween parties and a May Fair. I don't know whether they're still doing that because I don't live in New York anymore. But then I also went to things like Then She Fell. And I went to London after I graduated from IDP. And I was an extra in this production called You, Me, Bum Bum Train.
Okay.
Yeah. Which was about as weird as it sounds. It was like, there's no kind of cohesive narrative between scene to scene. It was just kind of a bunch of random scenes thrown together and the audience just goes through it and they experience whatever they experience. It's all very strange.
It sounds like when I run a game.
Yeah. I like kind of the surreal experiences of like, okay, these scenes are not connected. Just like go with it. It's fine. And then I went to a kind of dinner theater immersive thing called Gingerline. The show I went to was Madame Gingerline. It was all about this old opera singer who had like murdered her husband and then gone into the sewers, the London Underground and the sewers, and had her daughter there. And now it's her daughter's wedding. And it was really and each course of the meal corresponded to whatever was going on in the show. And I found that really, really fun. And then while I was at ITP, we had a class called Haunted House. That was the name of the class. And we built a haunted house for Halloween, and like it was a whole like immersive show, and we had people go through it. And the idea was that we're going to use technology and actors to kind of, you know, produce this immersive experience of going through this afterlife. And
amazing.
It was it got very LARPy. And at the time, I hadn't LARPed at that point. All right, I had done like some LARP adjacent stuff. But I hadn't actually LARPed, but it was a lot of the same skills are involved. Like you have to be able to think on your feet and improvise. And the one thing that's like extremely different between immersive theater and LARP in my mind is that you have this audience and you don't know how much they want to participate all the time. A lot of the time they're really kind of freaked out by what's going on, or they feel like overwhelmed and they don't know how much they're supposed to do. And sometimes this is like a design flaw with an immersive production where it's like, if the audience doesn't know how much they're supposed to be participating or interacting with the performers, you should probably set some guidelines for that. If like for no other reason than just for safety reasons. And I think actually immersive theater could learn a lot from what's going on with safety mechanics in LARP right now.
Wow. I agree a lot. Like we don't need to get into it too much, but I extremely agree.
Yes. But yeah, it's interesting because we have a whole roundtable that's going to be tackling this topic of like LARP versus immersive theater at Living Games Conference. But I'm going to say something that's like potentially a little bit raunchy, which is that I kind of compare it to BDSM in that the participants in a LARP want to be more active and dominant, and they want to have more control over what's going on in their experience. Whereas if you're an audience member going to an immersive theater production, typically what you're looking for is to have things done to you and for to have your, you know, experience guided and controlled by the performers. And I think, I mean, that's kind of a generalization, simplifies it, and people go into different things wanting different experiences, but that's kind of how I look at the big picture of it, at least.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that definitely like audience member as sub, which is not like a totally passive thing, but at the same time, like they're receiving content and responding to it rather than like a, wow, yeah, that's a really interesting analogy.
It changes the way that I've been thinking about how to approach design for both those things. Because sometimes I still go back and do something that's a little bit more along the lines of immersive theater rather than, you know, role playing on the LARP scale, or even like a tabletop scale. And I just think about like what I want, because I think that's where people tend to get angry about the idea of LARP and immersive theater being kind of meshed into one blob, the immersive theater LARP blob, is that people sometimes go into an immersive theater production wanting a LARP. And you can LARP a little bit at some productions, but it's a different art form. It's a completely different medium. And I think like trying to have the same expectations of both things is kind of silly. Like I wouldn't go into a LARP saying, okay, players, like just do stuff to me and I'm not going to really like give you stuff to work with. I just want to like experience whatever you're going to throw at me and not do any of the lifting. And I'm not going to go into an immersive theater production being like, I'm going to change the course of this entire story and I'm going to like revolutionize like what happens in this plot. So that helps me when I'm trying to set expectations for any kind of experience that's immersive that I'm going into.
Yeah, definitely. And I think maybe a lot of the concerns that people in LARP have about the popularity of immersive theater is that they're worried that people are going to come to their LARP with those expectations, right? People are going to come to their LARP expecting to have something, yeah, served to them rather than them being invited as a co-creator. Or even like, I worry about LARP itself being changed to meet those expectations. But I think, yeah, I like the way you phrase it as just a way of like setting expectations, right? Just letting people know that like what is required of you and what you will enjoy and should expect out of this is very different than what you can expect out of something that maybe you've experienced before.
Yeah, and I think that there is room to explore that space between LARP and interactive theater. Like there was definitely, I think it was a panel or like a workshop at Knutapunk last year that was specifically about this. That's a very interesting intersection that I don't want people to be afraid of exploring, because sometimes there's like a nice like in between space. And I don't think we're going to lose LARPers to immersive theater. If anything, I think we're dragging in, I mean, because that was my experience. I don't know if I would have been comfortable LARPing had I not experienced an immersive theater production first, just to kind of get used to this idea of immersion and being in a space that is kind of magical and separate from the rest of the world in that way.
Well, that's wonderful. And now you're making LARPs, you're designing LARPs and putting them together. I want to ask you about two things that you're working on. But first, we should talk a little bit more about what you mentioned. You're working with Living Games Conference. So you're the head of the design track specifically of their programming. I'm wondering, when it comes to putting together what will be the schedule of panels, workshops, and roundtable discussions, what are your priorities when it comes to setting programming and what's going to be there?
Well, luckily there's like a great inclusivity and accessibility team as well. And like, I am helping out a little bit with that. And so having talked to, I think that was the first meeting I ever took part of. And so having their input and being able to speak with them about what we're looking for in terms of diversity and inclusivity, bringing that knowledge into the whole programming aspect was incredibly helpful. And I'm very excited for the roundtables and panels and like everything we have going on. It's unlike anything else I've been to, where we're really focusing on giving people a platform that isn't, again, I'm going to talk about like the messy blob of smushing things together, where it's not just like, okay, well, this is like the marginalization panel. We just have the one of like, everybody fit yourself into this one. We're trying to really narrow down. And given people, like the people who are attending and who submitted panels and workshops and roundtables, they did a lot of the actual work of doing that, because we had some amazing proposals for table or roundtables. And panels. And I think like that was a really proud moment for me, just thinking about the community and the fact that like we have these amazing people who want to like talk about these things. And really our job was mainly just to kind of like make a space for them to talk about these things. Like they already wanted to talk about it. And then I just really impressed with, this is going to sound really basic, but I'm just like impressed with how intelligent people are. just like people, like just with like even the little blurbs they send in about, this is what I want to talk about. I'm like, whoa, yeah, like let's talk about that. Like you could have whole conferences about like any one of these roundtables that someone, you know, submitted. And I just think that's kind of amazing. And it's a combination of, this is something that's really fun to talk about, and this is something that's actually pretty serious also and really deserves like a really detailed and thoughtful and considered analysis. And luckily we just have a great group of people. And I don't know if I've ever been a part of a community before where I felt like I just like inherently trust people to speak about these things with compassion and just thoughtfulness on that kind of scale.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a rare and precious thing. I totally agree. I'm looking through the schedule now, which I get to see a little bit of because I'm doing a few panels. I'm super, super excited for queer game design. I am so excited to talk about that at a non-basic level. You know what I mean? Like just thinking about the kind of level of discussion I can have around that at Living Games, it's so exciting. But like, you know, some of the names of panels are like Bleed and Transformation, RPG Theory and History, Feminist Game Design, the Military and LARPing. Like, I want to go to that. I don't know anything about that. Like,
I'm moderating that one.
Oh, that's so exciting. That must be like kind of intense.
Yep, definitely. It's a very serious subject. And like, again, I would be potentially nervous in another context, but I think like, you know, we have like very responsible people just like all around.
Yeah, no, having that level of trust means you can have a much, much, much more productive conversation. Okay, can we talk about your games? I really want to ask you a couple of things about your games. So the one that I've had the pleasure of playing, you mentioned really early on in the show, The Long Drive Back from Busan, which is a game where you get to play a K-pop band.
Yeah, I wrote it for Golden Cobra and it won, oh God, I always kind of mix up the words in this title. It won the award for best game that incorporates meaningful non-romantic relationships.
Yay! Yay.
And that was really exciting because it was the first time I ever submitted to Golden Cobra.
That's so exciting. Oh, yay. I love when designs like this gets recognition and the opportunity to be played. I had a lot of fun with it, and I was not surprised, but like I think I was kind of nervous to approach the subject matter because like I know that K-pop is very like fun and exciting for lots of people, but it's also such a brutal exploitative industry. And I was thinking like, how do you represent both of those things in the LARP? Like, do you make it the fun dancing, singing LARP, or do you make it the like sad, like young people risking everything LARP? And I guess you made it both. You just decided to do both.
Yeah. I wrote the game and I was really nervous writing it too, because like the K-pop industry and just Korean entertainment in general is something that's really been important in my life. And it's important to a lot of people. And it's an industry that a lot of people just deeply love and is also deeply, deeply problematic on many levels. And it's interesting because also I grew up listening to like old K-pop, like back before, not like the, oh yeah, I listened to K-pop before it was cool, but like literally like back when I was about to say, I listened to K-pop when it was like really, really cheesy, given that like K-pop now also tends to be really cheesy. And like in a few years, we're going to look back on this era and be like, oh my God, those music videos are so cheesy. Look at what we're doing now. It's like so much better. But like, I was listening to it when it wasn't where it was now. And people would make fun of me for it a lot because, you know, it was, people just saw it as like this really cheesy copy of American pop music. It wasn't a cool thing at all. And so it was something I did kind of like in secret. And also I didn't have like a lot of Korean friends growing up. I've just like throughout my own life, I've seen this incredible transformation with the way that Korea and Korean entertainment is just perceived and Korean people. Like when I was growing up, I would never be able to go to a Korean, like a K-pop concert in America. First of all, because no K-pop concert was coming to North America at that time. Like no group was ever coming here because they just didn't have the popularity here. But like I went to go see Astro recently and I was in line and these girls behind me were talking about how hot the boys were in this group. And that's experience I never had growing up. Like Asian men are generally kind of desexualized a lot in Western cultures. And it's seeing people kind of like have this incredible thirst for Asian men is a really meaningful experience for a lot of Asian Americans, I think specifically also because we're surrounded by, you know, white people a lot of the time.
Yeah. And white beauty standards. And yeah,
exactly. And so just like that in and of itself was, and that was one of the reasons also why I chose specifically to have Long Drive Back to Busan focus on a male K-pop group, because like, I'm still kind of in awe of the fact, because Asian women have kind of always been objectified and fetishized. And now that like Korean and Asian men in general are starting to be objectified a little bit as well, I don't know if that's like a horror. Like part of me is like, oh, that's like weird, the language that they're using to talk about these guys. But now I'm also like, this is kind of incredible because this never would have happened. Like these people would never have been considered attractive before because people are, you know, prejudiced. So I kind of wanted to focus in on that for this game specifically. Also, I think it would have been a little bit too much to have the K-pop group in the game be women, because that's another just level of marginalization and just like that I wasn't really quite ready to tackle. But yeah, I wanted to aim for that kind of intersection of like, this is a, you know, these people produce music and music videos and all sorts of experiences that we love to consume, but what's going on behind the scenes to get that stuff out into the world is kind of horrific.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's amazing to write very honestly about this brutal process, but from a place of like real love. Yeah, it's a tough balance. The other thing that I really, really appreciated about the long drive back from Busan, and it's so funny because I was at a local con where we had just like 2 hours ago been talking with this relatively new LARPer who brought up like, do people play characters who are like a different race than them? Like, how could that ever be not awful? Like, is that a problem? And we had this conversation where we were like, well, sometimes people do it in the most awful way you can imagine. And then other times people completely ignore that. And then we suddenly have no characters of color in any of our games. And that's not really great either. And we were kind of talking about it like it was this totally unsolvable, like, eternal struggle or whatever. And then we played your game and you have like two paragraphs of explanation. That was just like, can you tell my listeners about the kimchi rule?
Oh yeah. So yeah, this is like a part that I felt was really important, but I was also really nervous because I was expecting backlash from like somebody out there in the world. Like, I don't know, just like the nebulous somebody who's like an asshole. But yeah, so essentially like the rules of the, there's like the cultural, it's, I think the header for that section is how playing Korean when you're not Korean, because, and this came up specifically for me because people in K-pop fandoms tend to like to use like a lot of Korean vocabulary and like do a lot of kind of Korean gestures, for lack of like a better term, and to kind of play at being Korean in a way that sometimes is like cute and okay and respectful, and then often is like very cultural appropriation-y in like a not cool way. So I have to take into consideration whenever I'm writing a game, like who the audience is and what the context for it's going to be. And like the LARP world in general is still just pretty overwhelmingly white in a lot of places. And so I'm not going to be always the person running the game. I'm not going to know the people who are necessarily playing my game. So I have to take that into consideration. So the rules were, so first of all, the kimchi rule. The kimchi rule is that this is not a win or lose game, but if anybody says the word kimchi, then they automatically lose. And that's because it might seem silly and people might be initially like, why is this a rule? But it's because like I can't count the number of times when like the fact that I'm Korean has been brought up in a conversation and someone has immediately brought up kimchi as if like, that my ethnicity can be summarized entirely by pickled cabbage, which like, and then people often sometimes will ask me like, but do you like kimchi? And it's like, yes, I like kimchi, but that has literally nothing to do with like anything else that's going on right now. It is not like the pinnacle of Korean existence. And then, like, there were other things just like not incorporating Korean vocabulary and terminology from the K-pop industry. That's like really more like at a higher level, because I also wanted it to be friendly to players who aren't super familiar and like embedded in that fandom, because it can get like there's some stuff that I had to look up, even being a Korean American. Like there's some terms that are like some slang that are just newer, and given my family came to this country in the 60s, so the Korean that vocabulary that we use is a little bit dated. I speak like a grandmother pretty much whenever I am like diving into Korean language. But I wanted to be friendly and also to avoid having situations where people will say or do insensitive things. So like another rule is I didn't want people bowing. Because given like people do bow a lot in the K-pop industry because it's a sign of respect. And when you're like meeting someone new or like a group that's older than you and has been around for longer, or if you're meeting like with producers, you're going to bow a lot. And the thing is that I grew up in America where if someone was using Korean vocabulary with me or bowing at me, they were like being racist and mocking my culture. And so I kind of wanted to also take into consideration, how am I going to feel if I'm running this game and someone like does this thing? And I felt like if I saw people bowing a lot, that was going to just like send me into flashback land of like childhood when people were making fun of my ethnicity. So I just decided that was probably a good call to make that not a thing. It's interesting also because I've had, when I was kind of initially designing the game, and sometimes I would just talk to other designers and some people who are just completely not in the LARP community whatsoever, just because it came up in conversation. But the other thing is that the K-pop industry has they're not fantastic when it comes to actually like cultural appropriation regarding other cultures. So specifically like Black American culture. And so I've kind of since, I didn't put that in the initial iteration of the rules because I wasn't sure what the best way to phrase it is. But now I've just kind of, whenever I talk about the game to people or when I ran it, I'll just say, don't vicariously appropriate somebody else's culture. Like, just because like these K-pop groups like do that a lot. Like, don't do, what is it, like 2 degrees, 3 degrees of cultural appropriation? Like, avoid that. But it's interesting because when people bring that up, I think it's always been so far like white people bringing this up, and there's this kind of idea of like, oh, I got you. Like, look, like, it's not just us, like look at the Koreans. But there's then this kind of unawareness of the fact that like all American popular music is like, yeah, stolen from Black people.
Yeah, literally
every genre. So I'm like, okay, but like, can we also examine the fact that like country music, pop music, rock, like everything is all has their origins there. And it's interesting. You learn a lot about people's views on cultural appropriation by writing a section like that.
Well, I just thought it was so concise and so focused on really like practical, helpful tips. Like, here are the things that are important in this game, and here are the things that are not important. Like, you know, not bowing at each other did not detract from the game, right? And I like, too, that you emphasize, even setting aside the cultural appropriation issue, if you roll up to a LARP and start using words that not everyone there is going to understand, or, you know, making cultural references that not everyone there is going to understand, like, that's just, from a improv perspective, that's just going to be really like difficult and make it hard for everyone to have a good time.
Yeah, I think if I had written a K-pop LARP that was specifically only for people who were both LARPers and also mega K-pop fans, that is a very niche, yeah, market. It's like, I can name like maybe 5 players who would be able to, yeah, tackle
that. It'd be a hell
that.
Of a game. It'd be a great game, but it's on its one run. It's one run that ever happened. I also overheard a little bit of a conversation about your newer game that you're working on called But Not Tonight, which is this like breakfast club, but in a bomb shelter, basically. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, pretty much. That's like the elevator pitch, a breakfast club in a fallout shelter.
And you were talking about including characters of color and trying to figure out, okay, knowing that I have no control over who is going to play who, how do I include like, how do I make a diverse cast, but in a way that will be performed respectfully? So that's interesting. Where are conversations like that leading?
Yeah, so I think one thing that's important to note before kind of advancing on this topic is that even like there's no like straightforward right answer. And I think a lot of the time people, there's this idea that like all marginalized LARPers kind of have this little like guidebook in their pocket that we're not sharing with the rest of the world of like, and like these simple solutions. And they're like, why aren't you sharing these solutions with us? It's because like, even amongst ourselves, like marginalized players don't always, and designers don't always agree on the best way to tackle these things. And I think what's Yeah, because I know, shocking. Like, we're not all one hive mind. We're not like some marginalization hive mind. But I think what's most important is that, like, even if these topics, these like design problems are really difficult and there is no simple solution, that's not like, well, that obviously just needs to be the end of the conversation then, because there's no solution, so we shouldn't try. I think that there are some solutions that are better than others and some that are much, much, much worse than others.
Yeah.
But like, so for the original game for But Not Tonight, and the idea is that it's kind of a nuclear panic freeform LARP where a bunch of high school students have to go hide in the bomb shelter with their guidance counselor because the air raid siren goes off, but then there's no radio in there and they don't know whether or not it was like a drill or it's an actual like nuclear fallout situation. And so for that, like, I've just, in the character artwork that I commissioned from Avery Puck Laskin, there is diversity in the art, just to kind of remind people that that's something that she probably be like, not everyone should default to playing white, especially if they're like not white. Like, my thing is, it's really important for me to be able to play my own ethnicity when pretty much whenever there's a situation where normally people would just kind of be defaulting everyone to being white characters. And so it's not explicitly addressed in design document for this game, because it's kind of, I wanted to leave it open for people to play whatever ethnicity that they are comfortable with, given like I would probably be uncomfortable with someone being like, oh yeah, I'm going, like, a, you know, someone playing a different ethnicity without there being any guides for that. And I guess like that's something that's, it's interesting, because sometimes you just don't address it in your design and then people will take that and like find weird ways to like make it weird. But like specifically the thing that I was trying to address is I wanted to do a 1950s version of that game, because you have completely different social cliques back then. Like, you have greasers and then you have, to use outsiders terminology, the socias. But the thing is, like, we had segregation still going on back then. And so I don't like, and it's a game that takes place in high school, and that I was thinking about different solutions for it potentially. And I just eventually came to the conclusion that it is not important enough for me to have a version of this game that takes place in the 50s to put people in a potentially really uncomfortable situation, because I just couldn't find, given I think that there are ways to design this game. But I have not found that solution for it yet. And I don't want to put something out in the world that hasn't been like really thoroughly tackled. Like I really want to be considerate. And sometimes, like, even as a marginalized person, you're not the person to design that game. And I think that's also just like a really important moment in any person who's like designing games life. where it's like, you just have this realization that like sometimes that game isn't for you to design. It's not for you to write. And it doesn't mean like don't include marginalized people in your writing. It just means like sometimes there's really serious topics and they really kind of require hands-on experience with that in order to write eloquently about it. And then, like, sometimes it's just not you, and that's okay. Like, there are other games you can write.
Yeah, there's so, so many games that are crying out to be made. And I think, you know, the idea of responsible design, right? We don't design things that hurt people, right? I'm not going to design a game that requires you to, like, jump off a cliff, you know, or like, spin around in a circle for 10 minutes. Like, you know, like, why would you?
Yeah, that would be a really concussion-friendly game.
Yeah, just responsible design. Like, it's real. You can do it. I believe in you.
Yeah. And it's often just like, it's just a matter of, it's interesting because there is this issue of sometimes I will occasionally get pinged by someone who's like, hey, I have this problem with my game that I'm trying to design that is in some way tackling an issue of marginalization. Can you fix it for me? And I'm like, and Janaea talks about this too, about the POC stamp of approval.
Jonea Kemper, a friend of the show, just for our listeners. God, I totally hear that. Like, hey, can you look at this and then tell me that it's good so that if someone else tells me that it's bad, I can say that you said that it was good?
Yeah. And like, because like, there's no queer stamp of approval. There's no, like, we do not have one who is speaking for the many, or like, you know, and if anybody claims to be able to speak on the behalf of like every single marginalized person out there, something is very wrong. But I think it's important to both be considerate of like how much emotional labor you're demanding of people. And so often like the solution I like to propose for that is like offer an exchange of, you know, skills or what have you. Sometimes actually like paying someone if you want them to do substantial design work for you, please pay them.
Yeah, maybe pay them a little bit.
Maybe a little bit. I just, cause it's not easy to like talk people through that, especially when there's like a lot of pressure for you to be like the one with the answers. Cause again, like it's no one person has all the answers.
Yeah. And I think like, that's why being part of a community of design is really important, right? Like someone just emerging out of the ether and saying, hey, is this good? Can you make it good? Like it's completely different than people who work with others all the time and seek feedback and give feedback and, you know, are in mutual relationships, you know, bringing something like that out there. Like it's totally, totally different, two different things to, you know, run things by people versus abdicate responsibility for whether or not your game is okay.
Yes, absolutely. And I think like social media has actually been very useful for that because people can bring up a question and like given you have to, you know, just accept the fact that sometimes people might have answers for you that you don't like or that make you feel like you're blocked in and your options are narrowed down a lot, or sometimes you'll get a risk if you've already designed a thing and people have a problem with it, you have to kind of just accept that maybe there's a flaw in design. It doesn't mean necessarily that like you're a horrible person or that you're not considerate. It's like people have to work on these things, and the important thing is being willing to work on these issues. But there's so many resources out there. I mean, we have so many awesome LARPers out there who are willing to give feedback and willing to share their opinions, especially in like a bigger group setting or a social media setting where it's less kind of like, tell me right now all the answers while we're like in this private chat. But you have, yeah, it's still nerve-wracking, I understand, for like a lot of people to, because it's an act of vulnerability when you're saying, I designed this thing, it's really close to my heart, it came out of me, I understand that maybe it's problematic for people, and I want to make it better, and I may have made a mistake already. Like that's takes bravery to be able to do that and like show that to the world. But I also think it's not only important, but necessary for designers to be able to do that.
You do that with every aspect of your work, right? You want to know whether the combat system is fun. You want to know whether the character creation, you know, attaches you to your character. Like it's not completely the same, but it's very, very similar, where it's going to be better if you talk to other people and if you let go of what you think it absolutely has to be, you know, and accept how it actually impacts others.
Yeah, it's part of the whole big picture. And I think it just deserves as much attention as, you know, the nitty gritty of the mechanics or, you know, the setting. If you're having like a really big blockbuster LARP and you're paying a lot of attention to like making the setting beautiful, like it deserves that kind of care and attention as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's wrap up by talking about Battle of the Boy Bands, because you sent me some imagery, I will say. And I'm just so excited. Like, I just love the idea of, because, you know, I talked about the Long Drive Back from Busan as this like complex game that, you know, really incorporates the positive and negative aspects of this fandom. But Battle of the Boy Bands is just like, look at these beautiful men and their impossible ambitions, and they're fabulous. Like, just please tell me where this game came from and where is it going?
Yeah, so Battle of the Boy Bands is a competitive card game, and I'm making it with, I have a small startup with a friend from grad school, Vicky Ho, and it's been in the works for a while. Like we did early prototypes like a while ago, and it's just kind of gone through several different iterations. And we also, we had another friend it's like everybody I know is from NYU undergrad game design, but my friend Nicole LaFell, who I also took game design classes with back in undergrad school, we worked on this card game that originally had like really just like goofy placeholder art. And then we went and we got in touch with an illustrator who goes by the name Ren Mio. That's R-E-N-M-I-O-U. And because we saw her portfolio and it just looked like it was just beautiful boys. She had some really nice, beautiful boys on there. And so we were like, this is the one. And I wanted to kind of, it was literally a shower idea I had where I was kind of thinking about, okay, like, what do I want to do next? And I was like, well, what about just like making a card game that's basically about K-pop or like the pop music industry that's highly influenced by K-pop? So this is a little bit less K-pop focused. It's a little bit more like general, but it has a lot of influence still from that whole crazy industry in that people are players are trying to sabotage each other. And like one card is like, you can send a shady character to go stage an accident for like another boy group. And so that boy will just like be taken out of play. And the boys all have like different images and talents. So like they can be singers or rappers or dancers, or they could just basically be hot. They're called hotties because that's like what they do. That's like the entire gist of their career. And the different images are like youthful or rebellious, which are kind of more traditional. Like you'll always find a market for youthful and rebellious boys. But then there's also the supernatural, futuristic and emo boys. And they're a little bit more like niche. Especially emo boys, because that genre is like fading away at this point and becoming just like a bunch of different subgenres. But it's more fun and sabotagey than Busan is. It's also a card game, so it's completely different like medium. But we're probably going to we're wrapping up the graphic design now. Our graphic designer is Nick Avalone, and we're really excited by like the way it's looking, and we're probably going to do a Kickstarter for it sometime in the nearish future. And yeah, that'll be like posted on my website. And also the company is Gender Interactive, and it'll be posted on that website as well once that goes live. But I'm really excited about it just because the artwork is so goofy. Like when I was writing out the design, the art direction document for the illustrator, it was just literally like, here, watch this K-pop music video. Here's this image of like this one guy, like wearing this ridiculous outfit, take that outfit and then put it on like this other person and give them wolf ears because like they're supernatural. And then another like thing that's actually, I guess, relevant to what we were talking about before is that it is K-pop influenced, but I really wanted there to be more diversity than just Korean boys or just like Japanese and Korean, just East Asian boys. So I kind of took a look at countries that have a lot of K-pop fans. Because there's a lot, like South America in general, like all across South America, there are a lot of K-pop and J-pop fans. And like, yeah, in different parts of like just all over Asia, not just East Asia, there are K-pop fans. And like Ghana, there are a lot of K-pop fans. So like there are boys from all these different countries that are included in the cards, given like their country is not marked on their cards, but they all have names that are kind of, you know, indicate their nationality. Because that was important to me to kind of have people who were a fan of this industry be able to see themselves reflected in the material. Like that's something that would have been really important to me growing up and consuming a lot of American media. And so if I can like help make that better in any small way, I want to.
Oh, that's beautiful. I really love that as a goal, as like a stated goal. Okay, so I want to make sure that my listeners can find your stuff. So I know Long Drive Back from Busan. Can you get that on the Golden Cobra website right now?
Not yet. I think pretty soon-ish. There's going to be the anthology that'll be released as a PDF, I believe. That's what they've done in previous years, at least. And then I will link. I have a website that I kind of just like amass all the random stuff into. It's not like a beautiful site, but it's functional. And that's cysdavis.com. And then, yeah, the Janitor Interactive website is just janitorinteractive.com. And then the podcast, I think, is j2c2productions.com. And it's also on iTunes under Read, Watch, Play, which is probably easier to find.
And so even though it's ending, there's like 2.5 years of episodes. I'm just plowing through it. It's lovely. Particularly, but not tonight, is that available to people yet? Because I know you're working on this 30-minute demo, which is also just a super cool concept. Is that out there yet, or are we still playtesting?
I'm sending out the freeform version of that to anybody who wants to run it. My goal is eventually to have it published in some, because I'm also working on the 30-minute demo is for the tabletop version. And I ran that and it got into the Boston Festival of Indie Games this past year. But Not Tonight got into Indiecade, but I had to withdraw from it because I wouldn't be able to make it out. So that was kind of a bummer. But my goal is eventually to release both the freeform game and the tabletop game as one book in some way. I don't have definite plans for it yet. So it's something I'm kind of looking into. I have other random 80s themed games that need playtesting, but I would think it would be kind of cool to include in that, given I am someone who was not alive during the 80s, but it is a decade that it was very important to my youth because I consumed a lot of 80s media.
Yeah, totally. Well, beautiful. Great. I'm so glad that people will be able to find this. So many awesome projects that you're a part of. Thank you so much for coming on this show. I'm really, really glad that you could make it. This was such a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I have an interesting relationship with Backstory because I listened to so much of it while horribly concussed.
I'm so glad. I feel like I was part of this recovery process.
Oh, you definitely were. Holding my hand while I had crossed eyes.
Yeah, while you're bedridden and I'm just sitting aside. That's a very Victorian image in my mind.
Oh yeah, it's very much part of the romantic tradition of I have the consumption. Yeah. And I'm very pale right now. I'm coughing up little bits of
blood. Yeah.
Please read to me.
I must cough 2 more drops of blood into my white handkerchief.
Yes, and then display it prominently for all to see.
Again to Cleo for joining me, and as always, thank you for listening. If you have thoughts on today's show, you can always get in touch with me via email. That's backstorypodcast@gmail.com. You can also tweet at me @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com and find more amazing RPG-related shows like Neo Scum. Neo Scum is a future fantasy comedy podcast featuring 5 Chicago improvisers antagonizing their way through the role-playing classic Shadowrun. It follows a group of misfits and outsiders, a chromehead decker, a teenage candy junkie klepto, a kid's show wizard with a petulant thirst for adventure, and the nastiest trucker this side of the robo-mason Dixon. Join the irascible Neo Scum crew as they dole out street justice to every deeb they encounter, whether they deserve it or not. Again, that's at oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You. You can find Ujiko on YouTube, SoundCloud, Spotify, and wherever else you get your chill beats. Talk to you later, friends.